with the church group when we were in the Black Hills and with the young people. But Pastor keeps saying this, that I was leading the group. Actually, the group was led by Pastor Tim and Steve Skerrin. They were the leaders of the group. I just went along as the speaker. Okay. Well, last time that I spoke, we went through and talked about the first 3 days of creation. So we're going to spend just a little bit of time in review, talking about the things we did there. Day one, we talked about the creation, and these were the things that were created on day one. The heavens, the earth, which would have been space and matter. We had time, which was created. Up until this time, there was no time. There was just eternity. And then we had the day and night were created on that time. And then also that when it speaks about the creation, the term was used was bara. And this term for creation is the idea that it was made from nothing. This was something that was totally new. This was not just refashioned. So we talked about that on day one. Then we had day two. And in day two, we talked about the firmament and the water on the earth. The firmament was the water which was up in the heavens. And the water on the earth at that time was totally covered with water. There was no dry land available. And the word which is used there was the Hebrew words asa and isor. And that means to make from something which was already there. God had created the hydrogen and the oxygen which you need to make the water. He had created the calcium and the potassium and phosphorus and all of the minerals that are found in the earth. That had been created on day one. Now he just took these and he refashioned these to make the earth and to make water from this. Just the same way as when you bake something, you take your raw ingredients and you put those together in certain proportions, never forgetting the chocolate chips. And so then you bake whatever you're baking. And so that's the connotation that we have for the asur and asa. Then on day three, we had the formation of the dry land and the plants. And again, the same word is used here. There was nothing new that had to be formed to form the dry land. We had nothing new had to be formed to form the plants. God had already created all of these things. And when we see that the dry land which was formed, we see that the Bible uses the singular. And in the singular, I can see that we have, the geologists have talked about this, that we have one continent that was originally formed, and then that has, by continental drift, has gone into the various places that we have the continents today. And I don't think that, I see no reason why this could not fit in with the biblical narrative. The scientists have called this continent Pangaea. And if you take a look at this, you can see that this could be North America. There's Alaska out there. There's New England. Not much of Florida there. There's not much to Florida today either. But anyway, and I lived there, so I can say that. This here would be Europe and Asia. This would be South America. Here we would have Africa. This would be Australia. This would be India, which moved on up here and formed the Himalayan Mountains. This part could be the Far East, Indochina, that part of the world. And so it could have moved into those places. And I don't see that there is anything anti-biblical about having this idea. So anyway, we have the first 3 days of creation. Then we'll go to day four. Let's read from chapter 1, verses 14 through 19. And I am reading from the ESV. And God said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the night from the day, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years, and let them be lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light upon the earth. And it was so. And God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night and the stars. And God set them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good, and there was evening, and there was morning, the fourth day. Okay, so we see the formation of these bodies, the heavenly bodies. Now we see that there were certain purposes for these bodies. We see that the sun was created to form the days. Now this is because of the rotation of the earth on its axis. I know that there are still some people that feel that we have a geocentric universe, which means that the earth is in the center and the sun is going around the earth every day. I'm a heliocentric individual on this. I think the mathematics of being a geocentrist are just, it just doesn't work. But anyway, we see that God created the sun to give us the days. Now, there was day and night already starting in day one. What was the light that we had for that? I think that that was the Shekinah glory of what God was shining on the earth at that time. I think we see that it tells us that in the new heavens and the new earth, there will be no need for the sun or the moon there because Jesus Christ and the Godhead will be our light. And I think that in this first few days that we had the same thing. Now, I've heard some people say, but yes, how would God just shine on one part of the world? I don't think that that's a problem. If God can make the world from nothing, He can decide to just shine on one half of the world and let it, you know, be day and night. So I don't think that that's a big problem. So anyway, the sun was created to give us the days. The moon was formed to give us seasons or to give us the seasons. We know that the Native Americans, if you know anything about their, they would talk about the harvest moon and various moons. And so journeys would be so many suns or so many days or so many moons, which would be so many months. And so many nations have used and people have used the moon to give them the seasons of the year. The sun also gives us the years. And the years are because the earth is now revolving all the way around the sun once every year. And so this gives us our years and our summer and winter and so on. So we have the purposes that's thus far. Then it also says that the heavenly bodies were given for signs. Now, some of these signs I see here, Psalm chapter 8, verses 3 and 4. When I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you care for him? I see this as a sign to put us in our proper place as far as this creation is concerned. Now, we sometimes get a little bit egocentric and think that we're pretty important. But when you go to see some of the areas of the world, you go to the Grand Canyon, you go to even the Black Hills, you climb to the top of Harney Peak, and you look on down, you're pretty small in comparison to everything that's out there. You get to the bottom of the Grand Canyon, you're pretty small when compared to the things there. And so we see that man should look at the heavens and see that this is the work of God and that man is really pretty small. However small man is, it says that you are mindful of him. And God is interested in each one of your lives. God wants to be involved in each one of your lives, even though you are a tiny, infinitesimal part of this world. And if you take a look at the whole universe and all of the galaxies, You are really tiny when compared with that. But God is interested in each one of you. And so the universe is a sign to us of God's interest in us. Chapter 19, verse 1, the heavens declare the glory of God. The sky above proclaims His handiwork. Again, if you get to a place where you don't have light pollution and you have a nice clear night and you can see the stars and you can see this whole canopy of stars and shooting stars and the northern lights and all of this type of thing, you just see the glory of God in creating all of this. We also have in Matthew chapter 16, verses 2 and 3, He answered to them, "When it is evening, you say it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning it will be stormy today, for the sky is red and threatening. You know how to interpret the sky, but cannot interpret the signs of the times." So this, from a more practical standpoint, the sun, the moon, and the stars is given to us for a practical being able to predict somewhat what the weather tomorrow is going to be like. And being fishermen, they were interested in this. They didn't want to get caught out in the middle of the Sea of Galilee if there was going to be a storm coming on in. And so we have this. We have the proverbs that have been formed today. You know, a red sky at night, sailor's delight. Red sky in the morning, sailor take warning. Okay, all of this has happened to do with the universe and how the universe functions and the weather and how it's going to be. And God is saying that my universe is actually assigned to you so that you can predict the weather. Luke chapter 21, verses 25 and 26. There will be signs in sun and moon and stars, and on the earth distress of nations, in perplexity because the roaring of the sea and the waves, people fainting with fear and with the foreboding of what is coming on the world, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken. There will also be signs as far as the end times are concerned. And this is what Luke is talking about. And how the end times are going to be triggered by certain astrophysical and signs in the sun, the moon, and the stars. Then we see in Romans chapter 1, verse 20, "For His invisible attributes, namely His eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made, so they are without excuse." And so the universe is a sign to man that there is a God. Now, Grant was talking about this in Sunday school class this morning, that man seems to be designed in such a way that we think about a God, we think of something to worship. And the sun, the moon, and the stars show man that there is someone far greater out there who could have designed this. So we see that this is what the earth was, or the universe was created for. Now, what was it not created for? It was not created for astrology. Now, there are two sciences. Well, there's one science and one false science or false science. Astronomy is the real science. Astrology is a fake science. The universe was not created for astrology, but God had already anticipated this, that man was going to be using this. And in Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 19, it says, "And beware lest you raise your eyes to heaven, and when you see the sun and the moon and the stars, all the host of heaven, you be drawn away and bow down to them and serve them, things that the Lord your God has allotted to all the peoples under the whole heavens." And so God was aware that man was going to do this, that man would have a propensity for this. Now, why did God create the sun, the moon, and the stars on day 4 rather than on day 1? Now, if I could be just a little bit facetious here, it seems to me it would have been more efficient to create the sun, the moon, and the stars on day 1 So he could have the sun for daylight already, so he didn't have to use his Shekinah glory or whatever else he did, and then come up with the sun, the moon, and the stars on day four. Now, why possibly did he not do this? I think this is because the propensity of people to worship the heavens. Now, if he would have created these on day one, that would have meant that this was the most important part of the creation. What is the most important part of the creation? God, and the fact that God was able to make this. That is the most important part of the creation. So possibly by putting the creation of the sun, the moon, and the stars on day four rather than on day one would make people think just a little bit, well, there's something more important than the sun, the moon, and the stars. There are many cultures and many peoples that have sun gods. Apollo and Helios are the Greek sun gods. Re was the Egyptian sun god. Even you Norwegians, you have a sun god. That was Sol. And so we have these various peoples, and I just took a few of them there that we see that many cultures have as being their primary god, the sun god, where the Yahweh is supposed to be the main god. So we see that God created the sun, the moon, and the stars on day four. He said that they were very good. He told us what the purpose was for these creations, and continues on. Then we go on to day five. And in day five, we'll read from chapter 1, verses 20 through 23. And God said, "Let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the heavens." So God created the great sea creatures and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swam, according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters in the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth." And there was evening, and there was morning, the fifth day. And so we see the creation of day five. The creation of the things that we had in day five were the animals which were now in the air and were in the water. Now this, when we think of this, right now you probably think of birds and fish. Okay, it could have included other things. Now dinosaurs, and there are some fossil dinosaurs. We didn't really see any fossil dinosaurs out in the Badlands and the Black Hills. There are none in the Black Hills, but there are fossil dinosaurs in the Badlands. And when you think of these, right away, Dino comes to mind. The Sinclair dinosaur comes to mind. T-Rex comes to mind. Those are the things that we think about as far as dinosaurs were concerned. Well, there's actually the plesiosaurs and the mosasaurs were dinosaurs that were water creatures. And then we have the pterodactyl and the pterosaurs. Those were air creatures. They were in the air. And so those could have been created or formed on day five also, because they were creatures of the water and creatures in the air. Now, with this, though, we see that now for the second time, the word bara is given to us. And when it says that God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds and everything that creeps on the earth, this is the word bara that's used again. Now, I think that this is what gives us difference between animals and the rest of the creation so far. The animals, as far as their body is concerned, had the same minerals in it that the earth had. So we just had to refashion those to give us these different animals. But there is a life here that is different from anything else that had been formed so far. I think this is what was created. This was the nefesh, or the soul. This was the aspect that makes something living rather than being inanimate. And so I think that we have the second word, the second time that create is used here to give us this life. Now we see that they were also told to reproduce after their kind. Genesis chapter 1 verse 12 tells us the earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed according to their own kinds, fruit, everything according to its own kind. We also see in chapters 1 verse 21, we have the same thing which we just read there. God created great sea creatures and every living creature that moves according to their kinds. And everything was formed this way. What does this mean to me? This means to me that we are not going to have evolution. We are not going to go from one kind to another. Now we have two kinds of evolution. There's microevolution and there's macroevolution. Microevolution is an actual fact. This occurs. This is the difference that there is between one generation and another generation. You take a look at your parents, you take a look at your children. You know that they are not exactly the same as you. In some situations, that's good. But anyway, we see that there is a difference there. Okay, this is a microevolutionary thing that occurs. There's these slight changes that occur. Macroevolution means that we go from one species to another, and scientists aren't totally convinced of what a species is yet. But you go from one distinct kind to another distinct kind. God says that wouldn't happen. They were going to reproduce after their kind. And so scientists have never, ever been able to show or to prove in the laboratory that you can go from, as Duane Gish used to say, from fish to gish. You can't go from fish to humans. You can't go from one species to another species. This has been told to us by God that there was going to be things reproducing only after their kind. So now we see that, again, we had the creation of the things that were in the air, the creation that were in the land. Then we see day six. We now have land animals and man that was created here. Genesis chapter 1, verses 24 through 27. And God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds, livestock and creeping things, and beasts of the earth according to their kinds. And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds, and the livestock according to their kinds, and everything that creeps on the ground according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness. Just a minute, I'll stop there with just the beasts at this time. So, we see the creation of the land animals and man. First we have that we have the living creatures, the livestock, or the domestic animals, the cattle. I think the King James says cattle were produced there. Okay, what would this be? These would be the domestic animals, or the animals that could be domesticated. There are certain animals that cannot be domesticated. Now, cattle can be pretty wild, but they can be domesticated. Dogs can be pretty wild, wolves and coyotes, but they can be domesticated. And so many of you have your best friend, animal friend. All right, so you have domesticated this, or that has been domesticated. And so God is, I think, giving us two different categories of animals here, those that can be domesticated, those that can be used by man, and then we have the beasts. These would be the wild animals. They have tried to domesticate zebras many times, but they just are totally undependable. They cannot seem to train them the way they can horses. Now, they look enough like a horse in prison garb, but anyway, they look enough like a horse, so you think that they might be able to be domesticated, but they just never can do this. The same thing with the bison or the buffalo. When we go through the Badlands or the Black Hills, and they tell you to stay close to the car. Do not get out and antagonize the buffalo. We had some that took a look at us from about 5 feet away, but nobody got out of the car. Again, because the bison is kind of like a cow or cattle, and some people raise them, but they can never be totally domesticated. And so there are certain animals that just have not been domesticated or can be domesticated. So these would be the other types of wild animals that God created on day six, or that God formed on day six. All of these were the ones that reproduced on land. Now, we had the ones that reproduced in water, the ones that primarily lived in the air on day five. Now we have the ones that are on land. Now, we see that man was then created, and this is in Genesis chapter 1, verse 28. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth. So God looked at his creation of all of the animals that he had created that were formed on the land and saw that there was still something that was missing. There was something that was necessary. And so this when he now created man. Now, in the creation of man, we have the third time that the word create is used. And this is in verse 27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. Now, not all theologians agree with me on this, and this is the fact that I am a trichotomist. A trichotomist means that there are three parts to each individual. There's matter, there's soul, and there's spirit. I see the matter as being the body that was formed, and this was created on day one. All of the things that were in the body are created on day one. You've probably seen analysis of how much you're actually worth. Somebody has figured out how much potassium is in your body, how much calcium, how much carbon, how much water, and so on, and all of these things, and they figure out how much you're worth. And I haven't seen the latest things on it, but it's somewhere around $3.57, something like that, if you take all of these elements. Now, actually, if you have, an artificial hip like I do with the titanium that's in there, then you're worth quite a bit more. So there are certain things that can increase or decrease this. But the body was created on day one, the elements that were in there. I also see the fact that man is living, that we have a life, an animal life type thing. We have a heart that beats. We have lungs that function. You have circulation. There are all of the processes that take place, which are found in all of the animals. That would be what I see as being this life. The third thing that I now see that God created is the spirit, or this is what he created in verse 27. And it says that he made man now in the image of God. None of the animals are made in the image of God. Now, the people that are dichotomists say that there's not that much difference between the soul and the spirit. But I see this as being separate. I just think that man is special, and that is the created part that is given here. That was not made from anything which was previously there in any of the animal life. So God formed and created man. He formed the body from what was already there, and he created man with the image, in the image of God, and the fact that we could have this relationship with God. No animals can have the relationship with God, even though they have a physical and physiological similarity to man. Now, I think that God did this for a purpose. We can study animals, and we can see how man functions in many ways. Some of you have heard of the Mayo brothers. Well, anyway, the male brothers used a lot of animals for experimentation so that they could transfer this information to their medical procedures. And animals are still being used today. I do not want to have a doctor operate on me who has only operated with a computer before that. I want him to actually have operated on an animal beforehand. God created animals, or he formed animals, with a similar physiological aspect to humans so that we could use these. Now we see also that man then is the epitome. He is the crowning achievement of this universe. Then it says that God blessed them in verse 28, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth. There are individuals that say that Christianity or Christians are some of the problem we have with the ecology of the earth because of the fact that we have been told to subdue it and that we are now using this only for our own purposes. That's not what God had intended. When God intended for man to subdue the earth, what it meant was that we were supposed to be stewards of God's creation. See, the words kind of change meaning as we go through life and as you go through years. And there are many words that I could use that have changed in their meaning over the last 100, 200 years. And this idea of subdue, many times you think that this means to get on top of, you know, and throttle something like that to subdue it. Or when you think of a law officer subduing a criminal, all right, they don't just say, you know, it would sure be nice if you would sit down and not be so rambunctious, you know, so that we can do things to you. I mean, they get in there and physically manhandle things. This is what we think of as far as the word subdue is concerned. That's not what subdue means in this aspect as far as God's creation. The word subdue that we have here means not to exploit, not to waste, not to despoil. It means to have a productive ordering of the earth and its inhabitants to yield its riches and accomplish God's purposes. That's a quote from John MacArthur. And I think that that's a very good analysis of the term subdue and how we should think of this here. That is what we have been placed on the earth for, to subdue this. My father was a rancher, and sometimes people would say, oh, you ranchers, all you're interested in with your cattle is that you make money off of those. And Dad used to say, if I don't take care of those cattle, they are not going to make any money for me. I have got to take care of those cattle. I have to treat those cattle right so that they will make some money for me. That is the idea of subdue here, what we do need to do to the earth. Now, there have been many people that have not done this, and so this has been to our shame. Then it also says that we are to replenish the earth. In the King James Bible uses the term replenish, and individuals have used this to say that this could fit in with the gap or the ruin reconstruction theory that I talked about when I spoke the last time, that there was a creation here that was destroyed and we are now supposed to replenish this. Again, replenish is a word that has been changed through time. Now, the ESV doesn't say replenish. It says be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth rather than to replenish. If we would take the dictionary of 1828, which was old-time dictionary. Now, the King James Bible was written in the 1600s. But the dictionary of 1828, the explanation or the description of the word replenish is to make full, to fill, to stock with, to inhabit, to settle, to occupy. And so when it says that man is supposed to replenish the earth, as the word was used back in the King James day, means exactly the same thing as it does now to fill the earth. And so man was placed here to fill the earth, to be stewards of the earth, and to glorify God. Then we see in Genesis chapter 1, verses 29 through 30, "And God said, Behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit, you shall have them for feed." I guess I forgot to switch through here. Sorry about that. Okay. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, there was morning, there was the sixth day. So we see then that, going back to what I was saying about the formation, Genesis 2:7 says, "Then the Lord God formed the man of dust from the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became the living creature." This is from Genesis chapter 2, and where we see that the body was formed from what was already there. Now, when we have... I really got behind on this. Sorry about this. Chapter 1, verses 29 to 31, we see that man was originally created as vegetarian, evidently, from this, because it only talks about the plants being given to us for food, because death had not come on the world at this time yet. And so that God gave us the plants. He gave the plants in the Garden of Eden. They could eat of anything that was there except this one tree, which then made that one tree the one thing that they wanted to eat. But anyway, we see this, that God made us as vegetarians. Now, this is not something that has continued on. And if you want to be a vegetarian, that is perfectly all right. There's nothing wrong with that. However, God has given us new options for things that we can have, and this is in Genesis chapter 2, Genesis chapter 9, verses 3 and 4. We will turn to that. This is at the close of the flood. "And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, Be fruitful and multiply." And then in verse 3 it says, "Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. And as I gave you the green plants, I give you everything." So God had given the green plants for food earlier. Now he is expanding the diet that they are to have. "But you shall not eat flesh with its life," that is, its blood. "And for your lifeblood I will require a reckoning. From every beast I will require it, and from man." And so we see that God did expand the nutritional possibilities for us, that we could now have animals. I don't know what the purpose for this was. It's possible that before sin entered into the world, that plant life took care of all of the necessary bodily requirements. But that after sin came into the world, it became more difficult to supply all of your nutritional needs just by eating plants. It can be done, but it's more difficult. So now animals were allowed to be eaten also. And so God expanded this. Then we go on to day 7, the day of rest. Now remember that the chapter headings are not a part of the inspired Word of God. And I think that Genesis chapter 2, verses 1 through 3 should still be part of Genesis chapter 1, because it's still talking about the creation. "Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day God finished his work that he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work that he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it God rested from all his work that he had done in creation." Now, why did God rest on the seventh day? Was God absolutely exhausted from this? Those of you that were on the Black Hills trip, when you got back from that, you were probably tired. And you rested for a little bit. Was that God's case? No, that was not God's case at all. He wasn't tired. But what he was doing was that he was establishing something for man. And that man needed a time of rest after their time of work. And so God placed the day seven to rest in it. And he talks about this in Exodus chapter 20 when he is talking to the children of Israel, that they were supposed to have this day of rest. One day in seven was to be a day of rest. Now, the day seven, rest, is kind of after the work was done. They did 6 days of work, and then they had the rest. And I see this as being a picture of the law. The law, you have to do certain things, and then you are rewarded for this. You work for a year, and then you get a week of vacation, or 2 weeks of vacation, this type of thing. Well, I think we are now where the early church worshiped on Sunday. That was their day of rest. We have Christ arising from the grave on Sunday, the day one of the week. And I see this as being a picture of grace. This is actually like being able to go to a job, taking your 2 weeks of vacation, and then going to work after this and deciding whether you really like your job or not, whether you want to stay there. Well, that's kind of the way grace is. Grace is giving us something that we don't deserve. And God has given us this grace that we have now. And I think that as we go from the Shabbat or the Saturday or the Sabbath, and most Christians have gone to the first day of the week, that this is a type of what God has done for us. As he has wrapped up the creation and gone on from there. As we go through this and as we finish up with this, the thing that I want us to see is, once again, how marvelous this creation is. We haven't spoken anything about how things are designed and how they fit together and how they work together. But we just have this tremendous marvel of creation and the God that we have, and that this God is not only concerned with this creation, but he is concerned with each individual part of the creation and each individual, all of those of you that are here. Shall we bow for a closing word of prayer, and I'll turn it back to the pastor. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you once again for the opportunity that we've had of being able to study the creation story and the things that we have here. We ask now that you would continue as we continue with the Lord's Supper, that it would be a blessing to our lives. We ask this in your precious name. Amen.